Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Anthony Brooks. In a world of instant tweets, instant editing on Wikipedia, and instant information, how do we determine what is true?
In a world of auto-tuned pop and Photoshopped pictures, how do we determine what is beautiful?
And in a world of political correctness and hyper-polarized politics, how do we determine what is good?
Those are the questions Howard Gardner grapples with in his new book, Truth, Beauty, and Goodness, Reframed.
Gardner is a psychologist, neuroscientist, and education professor at Harvard. In the early 80s, he blended the disciplines to form his concept of multiple intelligences, or the idea that forms of human intelligence are variable and do not emerge from a single measurable factor, like IQ. The theory revolutionized education.
In his new book on truth, beauty, and goodness, Gardner goes from revolutionary to what some might call a reactionary stance. And he wouldn't disagree entirely, because as I found out when I recently spoke with him, Gardner says he is reacting to what he sees as a dangerous attack on these three classical virtues.
Absolutely. One threat is comes out of the academy. It's what we call the postmodern critique, which basically says, what's this stuff about truth? Truth is whoever has power, and if you get the mic, you decide truth, or truthiness, as we sometimes say. The academy has long dismissed beauty as being an old-fashioned illusion. And as far as goodness, people love goodness, but the way we think about it is culturally relative. Every culture has its own sense of goodness, and who am I to challenge what the bongo bongo think and vice versa? So that's the postmodern critique, which has been with us for a while. And the digital media are, of course, technology, you know, internet, search engines, social networks, multi-user games. But the digital media are a wild west. There are no rules. And so you can't defend as an educator or indeed as a human being these notions of truth, beauty, and goodness unless you're quite aware of the posse of postmodernism and the posse of the digital media.
Well, there's a great deal to unpack within what you've just said, and I want to do that in a moment. But first, offer us your definitions. What is truth to you?
First of all, truth is the property of propositions. So it's really about statements. But I believe that ultimately one should be able to establish the truth value of propositions, of statements. The distinction I make in the book, which is a little bit more differentiated, is different disciplines have different truths, and how we think about historical truth is not the same as how we think about scientific truth. And then the professions, and I'm very interested in the professions, have what I call practical truths. Mm-hmm. In journalism, you don't memorize 100 different rules, but when you work in journalism, you know that you shouldn't just take a single person's word for it. You should probe. You should get other points of view. You should not quote people anonymously unless you think it's absolutely necessary. Similarly, law has its way of establishing truth, other engineering, architecture, and so on. So I don't say there's a single truth. I say that different disciplines and different professions have their own methods of establishing those truths. And if either the disciplines were to disappear, you know, history or science or math were to be banned, or the professions were to disintegrate, and let's say all lawyers were just employees of corporations who told them what to do and what not to do, then the chances of establishing truth would vanish.
So how about beauty?
I think the notion of a classical form of beauty with perfect ratios and with photographic realism is gone, gone forever. For me, beauty going forward are experiences. It can be objects. It can be encounters. It can be performances, which have three characteristics. One, they're interesting. Two, their form is memorable. I mean, you can hear an interesting thing in the news, but if it just becomes a proposition and you forget the form, it's no longer beautiful. And invites revisiting. So beautiful experience is one that captures your attention. The form is attractive and memorable, and you want to go see it again. And then I add kind of a bonus, a technical term, you get a tingle. But as long as the other three are present, I don't really care if you get a tingle. And I put forth in the book the notion that we ought to have portfolios of beauty. because anybody who follows the arts or nature changes their views over time. The stuff you like when you were 10 or 20 isn't and shouldn't be the same thing, the only things that you like when you're 50 or 70.
But the very fact that you say that everyone should have their own portfolio of beauty, that notions of beauty, even within one person's mind, can shift and change over time, to my ear, that sounds like a postmodernist sensibility of what beauty is.
I wouldn't disagree with that in the sense that it's a rejection of a canon. I say the most important thing is to be able to make distinctions among objects or arts, works of art or experiences, and then it's an option to you which you like better and which you like worse. If you simply can't make the distinctions and you say, well, I like this for some extraneous reason, then you've left the beauty ballpark, so to speak. So there is an objectivity there, because if you can't hear the differences, you can't see the differences, then I don't take your position seriously. I never thought about it before, but it's really the same in politics. I don't care who you vote for if you can't lay out any distinction between the two candidates, except maybe which ones look better on TV. I'm interested, do you know something about their positions? But we're getting into goodness now, not into...
Well, I was just going to ask you, so how is it that you see what goodness is or should be taught today?
Right. Truth is about propositions. Beauty is about experiences. And goodness is about relations to other people. And I introduced the distinction here, which has grown out of my work of the last 15 years, and I guess I have to say it's very dear to me, is the distinction between neighborhood morality on the one hand and the ethics of roles on the other. Neighborly morality is what human beings have always had the opportunity to do, and it really grows out of the kind of species we are, and particularly the fact that we evolved to know a small number of people, the people in our block, in our tribe. What the modern era, and if you will, the postmodern era has brought along, is what I call the ethics of roles. And the roles are basically the roles of worker and the roles of citizen. Now, people have always worked, but you didn't have any problem with good when everybody did the same thing, when everybody were farmers, everybody were hunters, and so on. But now we have dozens of different roles. I mentioned some of the professions before, journalism, engineer, architecture, teaching, and so on. And we did not evolve as a species to know what to do as journalists, for example. A wonderful example, which was just discussed.
Some would say that we've always had storytellers since the dawn of mankind, though.
Sure, but let me give you a wonderful example. Very recently, the minister, I think his name was Jones, in Florida, burned a Koran.
Right.
And whether or not all you journalists got together in some underground to discuss it, a decision was made by American journalists not to mention this at all, or really to downplay it, for I think quite valid reasons, namely the mischief it would cause. But of course, now in the days of the internet, somebody was certainly going to find out about it. I think it was, in fact, the cover was blown by a French journalist.
But it ended up causing much more than mischief.
Absolutely. But this is why, in any kind of a profession, whether it's law, journalism, and medicine, you have to renegotiate what the good is. Again, you might say, well, people have always belonged to tribes or community, of course. But to be a citizen, to vote for people who will represent you, and to think not just what's good for numero uno, but what's good for the broader polity, that's what a citizen is about.
But isn't modernity and digital media, aren't those things actually making us better world citizens than we've ever been before? Because, you know, our tribe is very much online. It's no longer the few dozen people I might know in my neighborhood or in my town, but potentially the millions of people whose ideas I encounter on the web, whom I feel much more connected to than I may have ever before.
Well, you're speaking as Meghna, and I'm speaking as Howard, and I would probably endorse that. But as you know, a lot of the media are what they call the big sort, people only exposed to the opinions that agree with them. So I would agree that we have a greater opportunity than ever before to become global citizens. The big challenge, we might even say the mega challenge, is to take the great cultural traditions, which are not just Western Abrahamic religions, and to knit together a ethic of roles which can really transcend boundaries.
You know, one thing that really struck me as I was reading your book is that when it comes to our individual or even collective efforts at realizing truth, beauty, and goodness, you say that one of the things that's really required in doing so is patience. And patience seems to be the thing that's most under attack in patience and attention in modern society.
Right. And that's why it's very easy for people not even to approach truth, if they simply look at the most visited website, and we now know that can be manipulated. And by the same token, if you don't have a range of aesthetic experiences and reflect on them, sure. The fact that one can achieve a better understanding of truth and a well-developed personal sense of beauty is by no means a guarantee that we will. So there's a tension there. But I'm an educator, and my job is to lay out the ways in which we could get closer to these things.
Well, and how do we do that? Because the key thing is how do we teach these values?
Right. I think that there's a different story for each of these. In the case of truth, that's really the function of formal education. People are never going to understand how we establish historical truth or scientific truth or mathematical truth unless they have formal schooling. And they're never going to understand the truths of the journalist or of the teacher or of the engineer unless they have a mentorship and they see how people make decisions and when they make mistakes, how they reflect on it. So that's really the province of education. Goodness is the toughest. And so we have a project at Harvard called the Good Work Project, where for 15 years we've been trying to figure out the best way to help people have good relations as human beings to other humans, both in the neighborly sense, but also and particularly in the ethics sense, so being good workers and good citizens. And I think that the most important things there are, number one, role models and mentors, people who engage young people right away in dealing with dilemmas like the one I just put forth. You know, should we broadcast when a kind of nutty minister to get attention decides to burn a Koran, knowing that it's going to cause a huge amount of damage? And these are not questions which anybody who thinks the answer is easy has been a professor for too long, I would say. You have to learn to analyze things to see both sides. But in the end, you have to make a decision. And the notion about good work, you have to be able to publicly defend it. It has to be transparent. And again, if you make a wrong decision or wrong choice, you say, well, this is how I should have done it.
Howard Gardner, forgive me for asking this, but in listening to you, it sounds as if you're advocating for something that seems a little old-fashioned. I mean, do you find surprise yourself in what seems to be kind of a traditional point of view as to the fact that we need to be teaching truth, beauty, and goodness today?
I have no problems with wrapping my way around things which have been around for a while. So, yeah, no, the way I would put it is traditional views have to be sifted through what's going on today, both in terms of philosophical analyses like postmodernism and in terms of technology. But I don't feel at the least defensive about this.
But I wonder, you're a psychologist by training, correct?
Right.
So ultimately, we're sifting them through our own personal experience. I mean, we find meaning in truth, beauty, and goodness through our own cognition. So given that, would it ever be possible to give prescriptive definitions of what is true, what is beautiful, and what is good?
What I would say is that the reason I locate truth in professions and in disciplines is because people have thought a long time about how to establish, say, scientific truth.
There's a collective consensus.
Yes, right, and how to establish journalistic truth. But as you pointed out earlier, those things are not completely frozen. And so we have to revisit these things all the time. And anybody in education who isn't humble about this, as I made a joke about professors, they've been a professor too long. And that's why we need to be challenged. And I welcome the challenge. But what would a world be like where nobody had any agreement about truth, where there were no longer any experiences which people called beautiful, and where good and bad were indistinguishable?
And final question for you. You seem to have a bone to pick with postmodernists, because you've mentioned your distaste for relativism a few times in the course of our conversation. That strikes me as so interesting, because someone could look at your body of work and the fact that you brought to the world the theory of multiple intelligences, right? Which sort of blew open the idea that there was one way to define human intelligence to begin with. I mean, that, if anything, is somewhat of a relativist theory.
Well, it's not a relativist theory. It's a pluralization theory. I didn't say let's throw it away. I said, but if you study the brain and the mind, it isn't that people who are smart in one thing are smart in everything. But since you ask what the struggle with, it's not really with postmodernism. The two bugbears in the book are excessive claims of evolutionary psychology, that we can explain everything about human beings in terms of our evolutionary history, and what's called rational choice economics, that if we just each pursue our own interest in our own way and use our reason to do so, everything will be fine. In the end of the book, I talk about the importance of chance, of history and of individuals and the differences they can make. That's where my heart really is.
So even though you're an educator, ultimately, is this a spiritual book?
If you want to call it a spiritual book, fine. I would probably call it existential, because spiritual has baggage that I don't want. But existential is a big question book, and it is clearly that.
Professor Howard Gardner, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure, Meghna. Thanks very much for having me.